Hello and welcome to another edition of The Ohm Show. Today, I'm talking to Kevin Scott, Chief Technology Officer of Microsoft. More importantly, a great photographer and a dear friend of mine. Hello, Kevin.
Thank you so much for having me. I've been really looking forward to this.
Thank you. I wanted to get a little, the Kevin story. I know a little bit of it, but not many people out there know who is Kevin Scott. So tell us about yourself.
Yeah. Well, part of Kevin Scott is like not talking about Kevin Scott, I'll try to overcome that for the next few minutes. So, yeah, I grew up in rural central Virginia in this little town of 250 people growing up in the 70s and 80s. And I had the incredible good fortune to be growing up like right around the time that the personal computing revolution was kicking into high gear. So right around the time I was 11 or 12 years old, you know, started to see like these really early, like sort of pre-IBM personal computers, like the Commodore 64 and the Atari 400 and 800 and whatnot in department stores. And Radio Shack had the, the TRS-80 and like the my first computer I actually bought. I had to save my money up for a couple of summers to be able to afford this thing. But it was Radio Shack's Color Computer 2. So it was like this sort of ugly rectangular beige box that you had to hook up to. Like, I had a little 13-inch color tube TV that you connected this thing to, and it booted from ROM with a basic interpreter, and like you could load programs into it either through cartridges or if you you could save and record your programs onto cassette tapes. This all probably sounds like barbaric to modern developer ears, but that was my first computer and how I learned how to program. And it was like really odd, like in retrospect, that any of this happened at all, because like we were poor, like we were in this very rural place. There were no communities of hackers or sort of like anything like what we have here in Silicon Valley now, just in terms of like that critical mass of people who are, you know, sort of making things. My dad was in construction, and
but he had the foresight to get you a computer.
He did. And it was, I don't think as a child I fully appreciated how much my mom and dad, like as limited as their resources were, sacrificed in order to get me that first computer. And then like when it became really clear that I had some talent for it as a high school student, like they bought me a real PC when I was a senior in high school. And like that was a huge sacrifice for them, like that machine. I mean, by today, it was a compact, like a used compact x86 machine. It had 2 5-1/4-inch floppy disk drives, and we upgraded one of them to a 20-megabyte Seagate hard disk. Yeah. It had this Hercules graphics monochrome monitor, so it was like slightly higher resolution than EVGA, but monochrome. And like, I love that machine. I wrote video games on it. I wrote like my dad's payroll system for the little construction company he was running at the time.
Funny thing you say that. My first computer was a Windows machine, Windows MS-DOS machine, which I acquired in 1990.
Nice.
I had never used a computer before that. I learned computing by reading about it and reading in books and writing some software on a piece of paper and then getting somebody else to execute it for me.
Yeah.
And so it's like a different world where we live in today, where there's so much compute available to young kids. And
yeah, it's even, it's staggering. Like when I even think about what I did at my startup, AdMob, like the things that my team had to do to like build this mobile advertising company. I joined AdMob in 2007, just a little bit after they had started. I think we were 25 people at the whole company when I got there.
2007?
Yeah. So I'd been at Google. There was a whole journey like getting there from, rural central Virginia to.
So tell me, you're in high school in rural Virginia.
Yeah.
You go to college in Virginia.
I do go to college in Virginia.
And then you jump to Germany. How does that happen?
Well, I had a couple of waypoints. So I got my undergraduate degree at this little place called Lynchburg College, which was near where my family lived. And like I was the first person in my family to go to college. And my mom went to what at the time they called a secretary school. And so it was like sort of an associate degree in, you know, sort of business administration, I guess. And she, when I was born, was working as a bank teller. And my dad was in construction. And I went to this little liberal arts school near where I grew up because it was the sort of the only place I knew where to apply to. You know, it was just like I didn't have a roadmap. And so it was like close and like they gave me a scholarship. And so that's where I went. And then I took a couple of years off to work because I was really tired of being as broke as I was. I saved up all of my money and then I went to get my master's degree at Wake Forest, which is in North Carolina. And I was there for a couple of years. And then I moved to the University of Virginia to work on my PhD. And so I met my wife at the University of Virginia, and she was an early modern European historian. And so she had lived in Germany for 5.5 years. She got her master's degree in history from the University of Münster in Nordrhein-Westfalen. And she had moved back to the United States to get her PhD in history. Like she was a far better academic than I was. Like she got in everywhere with full rides. And like for, you know, like a quirk of fate that I'm very grateful for, she chose to go to University of Virginia. Now, we normally would never have met there because the computer science department and the history department are nowhere near each other on campus. And needless to say, the historians were not hanging out with the computer scientists in any sort of structured way. So we met online, and this was in 2002, I guess.
Pre-Facebook.
No, oh yeah, way pre-Facebook. And it was like odd. Like we used to be slightly embarrassed to say that we met online because like it was like a weird thing in 2002. But you know, she had just passed her qualifying exams and she like placed a personal ad on The Onion and I responded to it. And she, you know, at the time knew the thing that historians did once they passed their qualifying exams is they went to Europe where all of their source documents were. You know, so she was a German historian. All of her documents were these 16th and 17th century works that were in the archives in Germany and like sort of nearby areas. And so like we fell in love and like I was in this like scramble to figure out how I was going to move to Germany with her. And I managed to get a lecturing position at the University of Göttingen that like just so happened at the time to have they taught computer science prior to 2002, but like it didn't have its own department until then. And so like they were organized in this department. Like I was trying to figure out like, how am I going to get a visa to be in Germany with my girlfriend? And I just like cold sent an email into the chair of the department. And he's like, yeah, I got a position for you. Come on over. And I had really, really good fortune.
And from there, you went to Google?
Yeah, I mean, so we were both trying to figure out what we wanted to be when we grew up. And both of us had planned on being college professors. Like that from the time I was 17 years old until I was 31, I think, like my goal in life was like get a PhD in computer science and become a computer science professor at a good university. And my wife had sort of the same goal in history. And we both got a little bit frustrated with academia right around the same time. And so we both ran out of grant money to be in Germany. And like, we had to sort of figure out like, okay, we either have to like double down and stay here, or like, we've got to go do something different. And I decided that I was going to go get a job, and I hadn't finished my PhD yet. And I sent my resume to a bunch of different places. And Google at the time was a few hundred engineers. This is in 2003. And I sent my resume in and they responded and they interviewed there. It was amazing. Like, they were super thoughtful. So I was a compiler guy in grad school and they stacked my entire interview slate where it was like all the compiler experts that were at Google, Google not being a compiler company. And so like, I just had this amazing interview with these six people who like I could talk about my work with, I could talk about their work. Like, I knew some of them by reputation. So I just had this amazing time. I'm like, wow, this is awesome. Like, if this is what it's going to be like to work for Google, this is the place. And I got an offer. And the icing on the cake was they were just starting their first remote engineering office. And they were like, you can either come to Mountain View or you can go to New York. And we were like, oh, New York, 100%. Like, you know, we've been living in Germany with no car and like we really like this whole sort of urban thing. And, you know, we were like, yeah, let's go live in Manhattan. It's going to be a blast. And we moved from Germany to New York City and we were there for three and a half years, I think.
And from there, you got the job at AdMob.
Yeah, we moved to California and I worked at Google for another year after we moved out here. I did a bunch of stuff at Google in both search and ads. And the very last thing is I was running all the big machine learning systems that ran the ads auction at Google, predicted the likelihood that someone was going to click on an ad. And they did a bunch of stuff to try to set the reserve price in the auction. And like, it basically, it was trying to optimize for the quality of the ads experience. We call the team Ads Quality. I did that for about a year. And then in 2007, I left to join AdMob. Yeah, that was crazy roller coaster ride. So just an amazing team, like pound for pound, like just one of the more amazing groups of people I've ever worked with in my life. And like, you just sort of look at the diaspora out of like what was a relatively small company when we exited, and like, just people are doing amazing things now.
As a writer, I remember championing AdMob pretty actively. Russell was one of our, like a longtime contributor to actually GitHub
earlier. Yeah.
And he had a really beautiful blog. And,
yep.
And then some of the other team members of yours, like, were just pretty amazing.
Yeah.
So, I mean, Google-wise, AdMob, and you're back in Google, like, you can't get away.
Yeah. And I remember it was funny when I left Google. People knew where I was going. And I remember they threw me this going away party and they're like, oh, ha, 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 we're just going to buy you in a few years and you'll be back. And I was like, no, never happened. And then a few years later, they bought us and I was back.
Now, you went to go work for LinkedIn and then LinkedIn became Microsoft. What has been the big lesson from your, you know, life at, you know, what are essentially Google when you joined? Was a small company, became a big company. You went to a small company, ended up at a big company again, Google. And then you went to a smallish company, which is LinkedIn, and then became part of a big company. So you've had this journey throughout the process.
Yeah.
Like, what has been the big lesson from all of this?
A bunch of lessons. So I remember when I left Google to go do AdMob, like I had this mission that I was on. It's like, I got there. I started at Google as a individual contributor. I was just a like regular engineer. And at some point I turned myself into a manager. And it's sort of weird at Google at the time. You like this whole, what your role was largely self-determined. And like, I was a good engineer, but, you know, I would look at Jeff Dean and say, like, yeah, I'm never going to be that good an engineer. Like, it's just incredible people there. And I thought that the problem that I identified that nobody was solving there was, like, we were hiring, particularly in New York City in 2003, like, these amazing people who were coming from Wall Street and the Bell Labs, which were, you know, sort of melting down a little bit at that point in time. You had all these smart people who would come into the company, and the deal with the company is like, come in and like, you sort of figure out what you want to work on. Like, you're smart people. Like, we trust that smart people will figure out like good things to work on. And some people could navigate that. And it was actually thrilling. Like I had left academia because I wanted to have a bigger impact on the world. So like the thing that I optimized for when I was trying to choose my first projects is like, what is something that's going to be intellectually interesting and that's going to have real business impact. And I just noticed a bunch of people around me who were way smarter than I was, like who were having a hard time, like sort of navigating, like how to choose the right thing, and who would, you know, would get excited about things that just looked to me like obviously not things that were going to have a huge amount of impact. And like, there were just all of these other things that like needed to be done at the company that, you know, they can benefit from smart people working on them. And so like, that's why I flipped myself to become a manager. And as soon as I became a manager, like I had this wrong-headed thought that's like, okay, well now I'm a manager. Like I should be running engineering somewhere, like just ridiculous hubris. Right. And so, you know, I was like, okay, what's the best way to become a manager? It's like, I'm going to have to like leave at some point and go to a smaller company that's going to be willing to take a bet on me. And so the best thing I can do right now is to sort of prepare for that. And it's like, I just exposed myself to like as many different experiences as I could. Like I, you know, they would ask me to do anything and I would say yes. It's like, oh, Kevin, we need you to go do due diligence on this company. I'm like, I don't know what, you know, what due diligence is, but yep, I'll go do it. Like we need somebody to help figure out a mentorship program for the company. Yep, I'll go do that. Like we need somebody to, you know, like to set up a faculty summit, to like have better relations with university. Yep, I'll go do that. And so, you know, I'm doing my day job and like trying to like get all of these experiences. And like, by the time I got to AdMob, like the problem that we were trying to solve, like this mobile advertising stuff, like there was just the product and the technology. Like I was pretty confident I could go sort out. There was a bunch of stuff about being a head of engineering, like I had no clue about, but I sort of felt that I had banked enough credits on like the product and technical expertise that like that would give me enough space where I could go learn all of this other stuff. And, you know, I think one of the interesting lessons I've had personally is to just sort of be very deliberate about what it is that you are trying to do. Like the more detailed your plan is, like the more likely it is that you're going to be able to, you know, get to a place that you want to be. And you know, it's really funny. Like I have conversations with folks all the time and they have some destination in mind, but they don't really know why they want to be there. Or like they don't really have a destination in mind at all. Like they've just got some pattern that they're trying to match against that somebody else's pattern and not theirs.
Well, you see that, right? Like in the Google came about and in many ways it popularized this whole notion of a loosey-goosey, you know, corporate culture, a much more unstructured way of, an ambiguous way of talking about your capabilities and your yes. goals and being politically correct and not being, you know, ruthlessly honest about things. That was a good gift of, you know, Google to the Silicon Valley culture. I think Facebook's gift to Silicon Valley culture was move fast, break things, don't worry about the consequences, right? When you think about it, now it works really well when you have highly functioning, super IQ people like in Google, or it's the first 500 people of Facebook.
Yeah.
But when you apply it to random startups Correct. With random talent, it becomes like a culture with like yoga pants and,
yeah.
you know, dogs at work and all that kind of nonsense, which is pervasive.
Well, and look, I think you're one of the things that I had to do when I joined AdMob is unlearn a whole bunch of the patterns that I had learned at Google. And Google was trying to solve a very different problem than AdMob was trying to solve. Like a lot of the problems that Google had at the time were these like super high ambition computer science problems where, you know, like they were like right out on the frontier of technology. Like nobody had solved this stuff before. And like it was, and you know, you sort of structure your environment to solve those problems well. And it felt, you know, like very much like a university. Like the transition from academia to Google was super soft. And like a lot of their process, like the promotion process there felt a lot like the tenure process in academia. It's like committee driven. You sort of like, you know, you're accountable for your own outcomes. Like, so a lot of it felt very collegial and like, you know, they got really great results out of it. But like you take that and like stuff it into a startup like AdMob and like, you know, it just doesn't work. Like the thing that we had going for us at the time is like we were trying to build this mobile advertising ecosystem, like not because like we thought that mobile ads were like inherently the best thing in the world, but because like if you'll sort of flashback, this is like pre-iPhone, you know, the thing that had driven AdMob's business up to the point where I joined, which was like right when the iPhone first came on the market, was WML advertising. So you know, you had carriers who like had a deck that where they decided like what was going to be on your phone. And like there was this chicken and egg problem for entrepreneurs where like they wanted distribution, like they wanted to be on the carrier's deck, but like the carriers weren't interested in cutting BD deals with companies that didn't have any traction. And so like the bootstrap was horrible. And like that was the problem AdMob was trying to solve. It's like, how can we get mobile entrepreneurs a distribution mechanism? And like, once they've got distribution and usage, like, how can they monetize themselves? And like, that's a whole all stop, like the reason why we were doing that. And like the environment that we were in is like, you had to be able to sort of seize every first mover advantage that you could possibly get. So the thing that we had to design ourselves for, just from a culture perspective and from, you know, just from like a even an engineering process and infrastructure perspective, was agility. And like that was very different from Google, very different. And it's not even something that, you know, like then I bounced back into Google for a while and then I go to LinkedIn before the IPO. And like LinkedIn was, you know, another one of these big growth things. Like, the engineering team was about 250 people when I joined. It was 3,100 engineers 6 years later when I stopped being head of engineering at LinkedIn and started being CTO at Microsoft. And I didn't do anything that I did at AdMob trying to set the culture for LinkedIn because it would have been insane.
Yeah. What is the good hygiene for setting up an engineering team in a small company? Let's say you go in at like, you know, AdMob was what, 10 people, 20
yeah,
people?
Yeah, about 10 engineers, and 20 people.
When Google acquired them, you guys were what, 250 maybe?
No, we were like 140 people, like maybe 60 engineers.
So what's like a good engineering team at that point in your mind? You know, now you work with enough startups, enough big companies. So at that stage, what does an engineering team look like versus, let's say, you are at a pre-growth spurt company like LinkedIn.
Yeah.
And then a pre, like, you know, and then you're like a big company like, maybe like, you know, post-IPO LinkedIn.
Yeah. Look, I think any engineering team needs to understand what its role in helping the company win. Like, we had this guy, Fred Kaufman, who worked with us at LinkedIn. And so, like, Fred's this interesting, like, economist, philosopher, business consultant sort of guy. He's like written two really amazing books. Like one that I especially like is called Conscious Business. And like Fred would come in and like do these sessions with folks. And like he would ask everyone, it's like, okay, you've got a soccer team. What's the role of the goalie? And like everybody would like, you know, raise their hands and self-assuredly say, oh, the goalie's job is to keep the ball from going in the goal. And Fred would be like, no, that is not the goalie's job. The goalie's job is to help the team win. And sometimes it means the goalie has to get out of position. And so like having this clear notion as an engineering team about what it is that you need to be doing to help your company win is like probably the most important thing that you need to do, whether you're a tiny little startup or you're a big, you know, company like Microsoft with tens of thousands of engineers. And a lot of people get super confused about that because like they sort of assume they just sort of make a bunch of silly assumptions that are more based on their personal preference for what they would like the engineering team to be than like sort of the reality of like what the engineering team can contribute to the company's success. In some places, like you need to like be very engineering driven because like the essence of your business is solving a bunch of really hard technology problems. In other contexts, like, you know, you need to be sales driven because like the, you know, you've already invented something that's sort of useful and interesting. And like the challenge is getting that interesting thing connected with paying customers. And so like just being honest with yourself, and like, it's hard to create like that sort of whole company team where like you've got great people in all of the positions and like everybody's sort of willing to like do their role if you like have a misconception that you're somehow the, you know, the star of the show when you're not.
That's an interesting point of view, you know, considering that, you know, you hear the story again and again where the business units and the engineering units are treated separately within a company, no matter how small or how big it is, that they try and keep them, you know, they have the business and product and engineering, and where you kind of look at that and, you know, it's like, if like, that makes no sense.
Yeah. And look, sometimes you need an individual team to sort of be able to assert itself. Yeah, I remember like one of the funny things at AdMob when I first got there is like, it was it's a small company, but it like had a small sales culture. It was like, let's go out and like, you know, book deals. Like, you know, we need to bring in revenue, and like totally reasonable thing. But at the time I showed up, like we've been doing that to the exclusion of like actually investing in infrastructure. And like, you need to be doing both in sort of a balanced way, because this advertising business was only going to be successful at scale. And like, there was no way to like scale up your revenue if your infrastructure was falling over. And it was sort of weird. Like our traffic peaks at AdMob tended to be over the weekend. Like mobile consumption was like really a leisure activity at the time. And so like you'd have people like, you know, at the ball game on the weekend, and, you know, they're checking scores or like out and about using their phone. And like, so weekends were a crap time. Like, and when I first got there, we were on the verge of collapse every weekend. It was all hands on deck. And, you know, like you're having to like tweak the, you know, your MySQL settings, you know, let's raise the connections to 700. It's almost like NASA, you know, command center. And, you know, at some point, like the team is fried, and like you are, you know, we were trapped in this, and like a lot of companies get into this where you sort of get trapped into this sort of cycle of technical debt where you've accumulated so much that you're almost at the point where you can't even pay the interest on the debt.
Yeah.
And then you just got to stop. And so like, I've done this twice now, once at AdMob and once at LinkedIn. And it's like, look, we got to stop. Like, we're, you know, no more special sales deals. Like, you can't, you know, sell an ad unit where, you know, like you're shaking the phone to like have a guy drop trousers for, you know, Dockers or whatever thing, you know, that somebody's willing to pay money for. Like, we got to stop now and spend a couple of months like shoring up all of this infrastructure. Otherwise, like, the business is going to collapse. And so like, some of it is like moment in time things. Like, you got to be able to do that. And then at other times it's like, look, you know, like, we got this big deal we got to do. Like, you know, I'm not the star of this show. Like, I need to come in and support this.
I think a lot of us have forgotten what it used to be. I mean, I've had many outage days on the GigaHome back in the day that, you know, first the Pearl would just kind of, you know, like the database couldn't handle anything. And then later in the MySQL, you know, would get jammed. And so like now you think about it, the cloud has become so pervasive that most people don't even think about such things, except for the credit card bill you get at the end of the month. That's a different story.
Yeah, and look, I think that's an incredible luxury. Like, we were a little bit too early at AdMob to build on top of the cloud. So I was building a bunch of infrastructure, and like, we had a data center team, and like, we had system integrators building racks of gear for us, and like, we had a architecture for an ad serving pod, and Like we were, you know, it's like all a bunch of stuff that like if I were doing it again, like you never do it that way. You just get all of this stuff from the cloud.
So let me ask you about, you know, now that it's like a nice segue from the past into the present, right? Yep. So you worked on advertising technology, which is viewed as, you know, advertising online is now viewed as a toxic product. Essentially, everybody dislikes it. And now you flip it from your point of view, that of an engineer who worked on the actual technology of advertising at Google.
Yeah.
You look at the impact of that in terms of technology. That has been pretty huge, right? Like the sheer, like it was one of the first major robust data sets to be put to use on a real-time basis.
Yep.
I wonder how you think about, you know, the way people talk about advertising, the technical achievements of advertising, like from an engineer's standpoint, how do you view that?
Yeah, look, so I think there's some amazingly innovative things that have happened with ad technology over the years. I don't know how big the systems are today, but, you know, like when I was running these ads quality systems, like the big machine learning systems at Google and 2007, like I'm pretty sure they were the biggest machine learning systems on the planet. Like it's just like epic scale what we were doing, and relatively little about me and mostly about like a very good group of people who were on that team. And the idea that we had in our heads then was, you know, not too dissimilar from this notion that we had at AdMob. Like we saw the advertising stuff as a facilitating technology for some. Like it wasn't necessarily the greatest thing in and of itself, but it was, you know, like you think about search advertising in particular, like it's a much better way, or so we thought, to like get advertisers connected with people who like had the intent to go buy something. And you could sort of measure how effective it was just in terms of how that intent got translated into a transaction. And so, like, I always, you know, just as a consumer, you know, in the grand scheme of things, like, I've spent 6 years of my life, I guess, like, intensely working just on advertising stuff. And then, like, I've had a bunch of roles, like, you know, at Microsoft and at LinkedIn, where, like, we have advertising businesses, and I sort of pay attention to what's going on there. But, like, it's not the thing that I'm spending all of my time on. But, you know, as a consumer, like, search advertising, like I think, is a pretty non-intrusive way to do marketing. And like it sort of pays for this service that's like really useful. You know, I'm constantly doing this thought exercise about what did my world look like in 1982 when I was a 10-year-old? And what would that world look like now in Gladys, Virginia, where I grew up? And it would be dramatically different, largely because there is a like an ad supported consumer internet. Like I would not have had enough money as a child, like growing up the way that I grew up, to like buy a subscription to a search service or to buy a subscription to Wikipedia or like, you know, any of the many things that you just sort of take for granted that are free and ubiquitous right now. And so like, I think that's the thing that, you know, I think is good about advertising. You know, some of this stuff where, you know, like you're getting into this, you know, race to the bottom to figure out like how many compromises you can make to like wring every last cent out of this ecosystem. Like, I don't think that's a good thing at all. And I think, you know, we collectively could be doing a better job drawing a set of lines saying like, you know, this is enough. And like, you know, we need to be more transparent about what's going on. And
well, I think, you know, I mean, I've been around long enough to know that, you know, when Google, and I pick on Google, but it could be any company, right? And when you look at Google or you look at Twitter or you look at Facebook, once you go public, you become trapped in this, you know, growth.
Yep.
You're on a treadmill of growth.
Yep.
You have to do it. If you don't do it, your stock falls and you lose the employees and the companies go away.
Yeah, I think you get nailed Yahoo. It.
You become a Yahoo, right? That's essentially what happens if you don't keep up the growth. I think that is not to say that the company shouldn't go go public. I think, you know, 2019, when I think about capitalism, we have gone, we've actually transcended into hyper-capitalism, where growth has been metacized to a point it is only for the sake of growth, not for the sake of society. I think there is a very fine line where capitalism becomes essentially criminalism. And I kind of worry that you might be skirting it right now. Very few companies have the consciousness to fight that, but the machine is set up to kind of spin out of control. I mean, that's how I sometimes worry about it. Not that I can, you know, I have any conclusive thoughts on it, but like I worry about that aspect.
Yeah, I think it's something where like we society should be spending more time thinking about like what the right incentive structures is for markets. Like I actually believe in markets. Like I think they're good things. In general, when I'm playing a game or like trying to do something, I like to sort of, you know, like tell me what the rules are and then like give me the autonomy to go off and, you know, do what I can do within the bounds of the rules. But like, it doesn't mean that, you know, the rules that we have for capitalism right now are like the, you know, sort of inviolable, like absolutely correct rules that have to be in order to support this market dynamic that supports all of this innovation. Like I don't know how close or far away from, you know, sort of skirting like any sort of terrible lines there are, but like, I do think that this dynamic that you point out where, you know, you sort of can very easily get into this cycle where, you know, it's growth for growth's sake, is like not a great thing. It's one of the reasons I enjoy my role at Microsoft right now, because, you know, like you think about our mission, it's empower every individual and organization on the planet to achieve more. And, you know, like we've got this heritage as a platform company. And so like, you've got this nice alignment where, you know, we win when the customers who are using our technology to build the things that matter to them win. And like, I think we need more of those, you know, sort of win-win alignment things.
So let me stop you for 1 minute here, right? Like, so this is an interesting conversation to have. You just shared your mission statement. You know, Google had its own mission statement. Facebook had its own mission statement. In this world of platforms, of these big, gigantic companies, I mean, Microsoft, by no stretch of imagination, is a small company.
No, right? We're not.
Look, do mission statements matter when all that people care about is...
No, they matter.
Know, like how this last quarter did.
Well, they matter a lot to the extent that the leadership and the employees of the company believe in the mission. So this mission for Microsoft is like something that Satya articulated when he took over the company like a handful of years ago. And like it really, you know, him constantly reinforcing it and the executive team constantly reinforcing it and us like taking action like on a daily basis that is consonant with the mission, like means that it becomes a reality. And Harari has like become, you know, maybe a little bit more popular out here than I'm usually like the one when like, you know, authors and ideas get a little bit too popular, I run away from them. But, you know, I sort of like this notion that he introduced in Sapiens that, you know, the thing that allows us to function as societies are like our ability to, you know, sort of create and share stories about like the world that we live in. And that like a lot of our constructs are really like shared fiction, you know, like I sort of said to a bunch of people, you know, like Microsoft, without a shared belief of like Microsoft's employees and customers, that it is a thing, would just be like a collection of real estate and some, you know, like data centers that are like in a progressive state of decay, with no one tending them. So, you know, I think missions in the sense that like at the very highest level, they are like a galvanizing force that sort of articulates, like, it's not specific enough to like inform, you know, like the work that you need to do to like get your thing launched or whatnot. But it's like, it can be a really powerful litmus mm-hmm. test that you've got to like say like what's in or what's out.
Right. I mean, you know, I think I maybe there is a part of me which kind of gets a little cynical at times. I'm not a part of me, a big part.
Oh, dude,
of
me. I'm totally cynical about mission statements.
But like, you know, you talk about people, you know, and how they get motivated. But it's the same people. You and I probably know many of them who left jobs at Apple and Cisco and all these big companies. And they went to go work for Juul, which is essentially selling, you know, like a drug to their kids. And people still were okay with it because it's the only way to live in Silicon Valley, Bay Area, because it costs a lot of money to live in. So you will do the dance with the devil in many ways. So that's why I kind of wonder why, you know, even if mission statements, should we even be thinking about them? Anyway, let's turn to more positive things. I do not want to talk about negative things. I want to talk about the cloud, the data, the machine learning, all the cool technologies which are out there, which yep. make me so excited about today and tomorrow.
Yeah.
I want to know what is exciting you about those things. What's your view of the world of technology?
Yeah. You know, the thing that excites me, I've always been, from the first programs that I wrote when I was a little kid, I've always been interested in the platform part of computing. It's like, I've always thought about like, what can I do that somebody else can then use to go make something? And over time, God, it's a long time now, really long time. So many decades now that I've been doing this, the level of abstraction that people, the level of abstractions that people are dealing with on a day-to-day basis to create things has gotten higher and higher and higher. So it's like really amazing, like what you can sit down and do that would have been difficult or impossible to do just a few years ago. And I'm sort of excited about like how those abstractions like are going to continue to get raised, maybe at an accelerating pace over the next decade. And like AI is one of those places where, you know, if I think back to the first project, real project that I did at Google was what by today's standards is a relatively simple machine learning classification problem. It took me a bunch of months to, you know, build this thing. And then it was in production for a really long while in the ad system. And today I could sit down with some of the frameworks that we have and like cloud training and whatnot. And like I could build something that's better than this sorry old piece of crap that I built 12 years ago, built in 2004. So it was like 15 years ago. Jesus Christ. In like a couple of days. And so like that's a really exciting idea for me. And like, I think there's this self-reinforcing feedback loop with machine learning where you're going to start to see machine learning itself, like changing what the programming paradigm actually looks like. So you're going to go less away from like programming, you know, for the past couple hundred years since like, you know, Lady Ada Lovelace like sat down and like wrote the first you know, the first modern program has been about like somebody sitting down and understanding like all of the complexity of a machine and like using a bunch of these sort of techniques and abstractions to bridge the gap between a human conception of a problem and like what this machine is able to do in service of solving it. It's not a, you know, sort of an accessible activity for a lot of people. Mm-hmm. Like even folks, you know, I think who could do it. Like I look at my wife, she's smarter than I am, right? Like my wife could totally like be a better engineer than I am. But like she looks at this whole, you know, sort of programming business is like, why would anybody don't want to do this. Like, I just sort of can't imagine. And so, like, I think, you know, AI machine learning, like, has the real possibility over the next few years to, like, turn programming into more of a teaching activity, where it's less about telling a machine exactly how to solve a problem and more about teaching a machine, like, how to solve a problem in human terms.
So sort of like how, you know, in the early days of Industrial Revolution, you knew exactly how to make the machine work.
Yep.
And then you knew how to make parts.
Yep.
Not the machine. You didn't care about how the machine worked.
Yep.
In like towards the end of, in let's say 1970, 80s onwards, we've seen more and more robotic, you know, automation of the industrial processes,
yep,
where focus is on making things rather than knowing how the machine works. So
yep,
you see the same parallels in the software domain as well.
Well, it's been on this inexorable trend. You know, you used to, you know, you just sort of trace back over like the last 60 years or so. You know, you go from, you know, writing in machine code where you're like flipping, you know, like switches to like binary code, you know, assembly instructions into a machine to like bootstrap its punch paper tape reader so it can get like its next level bootloader in memory, to today where you can sort of sit down at a web browser and like punch a few buttons and like you've got a scalable cluster spun up that can like serve as much web traffic as you want, right? So like there's this huge like abstraction gap between these, right? And like the thing that I'm saying is like I think it's going to get even more powerful, you know, from an abstraction perspective, where you don't necessarily, you're not even going to need to be, you know, like an engineer with a software engineering degree or a computer scientist to like be able to harness a lot of this power. You're just going to be able to say like, hey, I got this problem. Like, you know, let me describe it to you. And the machine is going to be able to go sort it out.
You know, I get excited about all that stuff. But when I think about that, I also think about the phase, which is going to be where, you know, right now we have this two-dimensional idea of technology and how we access it. Like in a sense, you know, there is a screen and there is a keyboard or touch.
Yep.
But, you know, I think about the world where compute is accessible to us,
yep,
through haptic mechanisms.
Yep.
And I'm just like, you know, I don't know what advertising looks like in that format. Hopefully it's not there. Something else comes around, how we consume media,
yep,
what media is. What is productivity? What is writing software in that time?
Yep.
I think to me, when I think about that, I don't know when that's going to happen. But that's the exciting part of all these,
yeah,
technologies and when they merge together.
I totally
do you
agree.
Have a guess on how long before we see that future emerge?
Look, I think it's coming. You can sort of see the, you know, the first glimmers of it right now, like all of these voice powered devices that are showing up in the marketplace is sort of like what phase it is, but like it's sort of the current phase. One of the things that I spend a bunch of time thinking about is like, what do we need to create from a platform perspective to make it easier to create a larger diversity of these devices? Because I don't think the right answer is like you've got one thing and it's got like, you know, 12 million skills and it solves all of your problems. Like, I think the more likely world that we'll live in is, you know, like we're sitting here in a conference room right now having this conversation, and there's like a thermostat, a lighting controller, and a clock on the wall, and a TV, and like all of these things are going to have powerful enough compute embedded in them over the coming years where they'll be able to do first level AI stuff. So like they'll, you know, should you equip them with a camera, they will be able to see and respond to gestures and your position. And like maybe they can read your body language and your mood and sort of adapt the environment to suit your needs. Like they may have voice sensors so that you can talk to them. They may have like a whole bunch of other, you know, temperature sensors or infrared cameras, blah, 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 right? And it's super exciting to me to think about a world where, like right now, it's sort of difficult to build one of those devices because you have to sort of, every intelligent device you've got in an environment is its own little vertically integrated stack of things. Mm-hmm. You know, you sort of have designed it from the ground up. They're relatively little standards. I mean, there are better standards for embedded systems than there were 20 years ago, where it like really was like roll your own. Like now you've got, you know, some reasonable choices for, you know, your board level infrastructure, like Raspberry Pis and Arduinos and, you know, like a bunch of different things, like that. And, you know, even Android, you know, for instance, is like a pretty good platform for building embedded systems. But like, it's not enough. It's so hard to like build one of these things. And so like, I think the next layer of services need to come in over the next few years. And when it does, like, you know, I think you really can have real ubiquitous intelligent computing in your life, where we can build smarter software.
I think that would be the more fun part. This perception computing is what I'm excited about. Before we go, there are two things I want to talk about.
Yep.
So what does a CTO of Microsoft really do?
Well, you know, I think the CTO title is, it means a bunch of different things depending on which company you're at. Like sometimes people use CTO as a synonym for like head of engineering and like, you know, the person, you know, he or she is running an entire group of engineers. At some places, like a CTO is like an outbound person who spends most of their time chatting with customers. The flavor of CTO that I am at Microsoft is I'm the person who's trying to help our CEO and my peers on the leadership team try to figure out like where all of the things are that fall, technology things that fall between the gaps in their organizations. So like what are common pieces of infrastructure we need to build to support like all of our ambitions at Microsoft? Like where are the places where we're unnecessarily duplicating effort? Like what are the you know, what are the investments that we should be making that, you know, if you sort of think about them in like any of the individual groups, like don't have enough critical mass to like, you know, get proper investment. And then, you know, I tend to spend about 30% of my time thinking about like right now and 70% of my time thinking about like, what are we going to really regret not doing 3 to 5 years from now if we don't start soon. And so like what is a practical matter that's meant for me over the past 2 years is I spent a bunch of time thinking about AI because it's one of those things that, and like, I shouldn't even say AI is like a junk word. I spent a lot of time thinking about machine learning, and it is one of those things where doing machine learning really well requires substantial amounts of investment, doing it in a way where your internal investments can be packaged up in ways that become platforms for people outside of the company is like really hard and requires a little bit of extra effort that like might otherwise seem unnatural, but it's really important to do if you believe that machine learning is like one of these very important, you know, sort of platform technologies that we're building for the future. You want to make sure it's accessible to everyone to use. And then, you know, it's one of those things that, you know, like once you have a platform that lets you do really effective machine learning, then, you know, it sort of supports a bunch of different things, you know, like from gaming to Office to search to, it will become like one of those sort of repertoire things for computer scientists and programmers where like everybody needs to have it in their bag of tricks.
I think in part two of our conversation, we should talk about all those things. But before I go, let's talk about Kevin, the photographer. What have you been up to when it comes to photography?
Yeah.
And how did you start taking photos and like what prompted you?
You know, my first photos I took were when I was a little kid. My mom bought me a Bugs Bunny instant camera. You know, it was one of those like little film camera things. It was a kid's toy, but it took real real pictures, and I've got this whole roll of film and a bunch of prints. The first pictures that I ever took were the back of my little brother's head. I think I was 7 and he was like 3.5 at the time. And like, I'm chasing him around, like snapping these photos, and all I've got are like his curls blowing in the wind. And like, he gave me the best present ever a few years ago. Like, he tracked this camera down on eBay that my mom had, and like found one that was still in its original packaging and like gave it to me. And it's like in my prize camera collection right now. Like, I've got a many, many cameras. And like, that one is the one that's the most special to me. And so, you know, it's interesting. It's always been about taking pictures of people. Like, I've done a little bit of landscape work, and I know like you really love landscape photography. Like, I've never like developed a real emotional connection with landscape photography. I enjoy doing it, but like, it's not the thing that, you know, sort of replenishes my, you know, sort of creative reserves. And so like, I do a bunch of portrait photography and have for a bunch of years.
Yeah. But you're a very people's person. I know you've been doing a lot of work around helping people in other parts of America and like teaching them, or giving them skills to be more equipped for the future, which is more automated. So I think it doesn't surprise me that you like taking photographs of people, because I like taking photographs of rocks, because rocks don't talk back.
Yeah. It's, you know, it is a little odd, because I am a capital I introvert. Like you say, I'm a people person, and I don't know where it comes from. I care a lot about people, and you know, as you mentioned, like, I really, really care about rural people and, you know, sort of folks who like may feel like their future is a little less unsure. And like, I hope, you know, I can help a little bit, like make their future feel a little bit more, more hopeful. And like, I also love those parts of the country. Like, I just like have a deep affection for them. And like, you know, the people there are amazing. And like, you know, there's an enormous amount of dignity that they all have in like their communities and whatnot. But I'm an introvert. So like, it's odd that I've chosen portrait photography as my photographic medium, because like, I'd be perfectly happy going, you know, home tonight and sitting in a dark room and like not talking to anyone for a while.
Well, I don't know if I will classify you as an introvert, because every time I meet with you, I leave with more questions and I desire to spend more time with you. And thank you, Kevin, for just a great conversation. I could go on for a couple of more hours, but I know
you have a
very important job to do versus me, who likes to just gab. So thank you so much.
Thank you so much.
And it's been an honor and a pleasure.
A ton of fun. Thank you so much.
Thank you.